this week on Life and Faith.
When I sat down so long ago now, you know, thinking about I'm going to write this book, I said to myself, and I've tried to keep this faith. I said, I know what I'll do will be heretical, but I don't want it to be blasphemous. You know, I don't want it to be a kick in the guts of something. I don't want it to be gratuitous. I don't want it to do it in bad faith. If I didn't care about Christianity, then don't do this book. Why do it?
We have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free.
I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world.
Miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. They just get their attention.
And so I had to run with my child on my back, the ISA army coming behind us.
I said, gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist. Son, he said, nothing's too good for the worker. Nothing.
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart. Christos Tsolkas is an Australian novelist, well known for provocative and disturbing stories like The Slap and Barracuda. In his most recent book, Damascus, Tsolkas turns his hand to historical fiction and has chosen as his subject the Apostle Paul and the early decades of Christianity. Paul, of course, was a prominent tormentor of the early Christians, but his dramatic conversion on the road to Damascus saw him confronted with the resurrected Jesus, after which he became the chief missionary of the Christian gospel to the pagan world. Christos Tsolkas grew up in a Greek Orthodox family, his mum a devoted believer. But as a young gay man, Tsolkas felt he couldn't reconcile faith with his sexuality. But Christianity and the Apostle Paul have remained a big presence in his life. Christos says that at a time of great despair in his 20s, he came back to reading Paul, and what he found was solace, compassion, and understanding. Tsolkas says he no longer believes the central myths of Christianity, but retains a deep interest in its influence and central concepts in which he finds beauty and richness and depth. His book is confronting, certainly controversial, especially for believers, but it also provides a compelling, stunning imaginative vision of life in the first century Greco-Roman world and what happened when that world collided with the teachings of an obscure Jewish rabbi who'd been executed on a Roman cross. It's important to say we speak about some pretty heavy topics in this interview. It's not suitable for everyone. I spoke with Christos Tsolkas from his home in Melbourne. I'm sure lots of people would have been perhaps surprised, a bit intrigued that someone who is not a believer, at least not in the conventional sense, would want to base a novel on this. And yet, of course, it's not really surprising in another sense in that Western art and literature and music and draws on this story so richly and deeply, doesn't it? This follows in a tradition in some senses.
It's one of the things that always frustrated me about what's called now the new atheism of about 15, 20 years ago, was this really reductionist understanding of what the religious experience is and what awe is. You know, talking about people's responses to it, I am so grateful for this young man who came, he must be in his 30s. He came up to me at an event I did talking about the book, and he said that he had grown up in an atheist household, had not thought very much about religion at all until 2001 happened, when he was quite young.
Yeah.
And he realized that he knew nothing about the basis of our culture, where it came from, that he had never been taught that. And he went back and he said to me, these are, you know, that he has been going to church, to a church group ever since that point. He says, I still don't know if I understand faith, but I do want to understand what is it that has created the world we live in now, you know, and I think that's what I want to say to people who are so dismissive of the religious experience. One is, even if you don't understand the transfigurative experience of faith, of belief. Because I think, you know, if even if you don't, you must want to understand history. You must want to understand language. You must want to understand where we come from. And to deny that experience as being formative to our consciousness and our is and to the kind of society we have is, to me, frankly, ridiculous. And the other thing, Simon, for me as well is, and I've been really conscious, I was, when I sat down so long ago now, you know, thinking about I'm going to write this book, I said to myself, and I've tried to keep this faith, I said I know what I'll do will be heretical, but I don't want it to be blasphemous. You know, I don't want it to be a kick in the guts of something. I don't want it to be gratuitous. I don't want it to do it in bad faith. If I didn't care about Christianity, then don't do this book. Why do it? Yeah. And the second part of what I don't understand with some of the new atheists is some of the people I've loved most in my life have that faith.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't, and I think that there is something fundamentalist in that level of atheism, which will deny that human connection. So look at my mother. My mother has the deepest faith of anyone I know. And she was the one that, it was a great moment in terms of my relationship with Paul that years ago, I mean, it took a long time for us to be able to have the adult conversation about sexuality because she didn't, you know, her English isn't great. She doesn't, you know, we were, you know, in a way you're, that's kind of sometimes the complexity of being a child of migrants, that you're actually you're both using a language that belongs to 13 or 14 year olds, right? You don't have, I don't know the abstract terms in Greek, but we were talking some time ago and I knew there was a period where she was in great despair herself. And she, you know, I said, how did you survive kind of the pain of me coming out as gay? Because it was a really horrible shock to her. She didn't have the support that I had around me. And she said she had read Paul. I mean, I just want to say that to some of the church leaders, right? My mother's faith is really direct and clear. She can read this in Paul. That, and what she said to me is, because I asked, what did you find in Paul? And she said that God loves my son.
So let's back up a bit here. There were some very formative moments in Christos Tsolkas' early life that helped to explain both his interest in and battles with Christian faith. I asked him about the way he came to lose the faith of his family.
My first encounter with Paul was the Paul of Corinthians 1, which is that as a sinner, as a homosexual, that I was barred from God's love. That's how I read Paul. I tried so desperately hard to be good Christian in the way that I thought that was the sense of Christianity I was getting, I understood back then. In that really adolescent way, I think a lot of us go through that experience of faith. I had to reject faith, which I did at 15, because I just couldn't reconcile it, Simon. It just didn't seem possible. I didn't have the intellectual or emotional or resources to do it.
You probably weren't getting a lot of help from anywhere either to do that, right?
Having said that, actually, where I did get help, and I think this is important, because I think it was part of an illumination that I may not have been aware of at the time. I got it from books and I got it from films. I got it from art. That there were actually, when I look back at it, I was reading Dostoevsky from really young, right? And I was reading Dostoevsky because I had one, I mean, I do think there are teachers who actually can change lives. And I had one in a man called Yaroslav Havir, who was a Czech immigrant to Australia who loved European literature. And he introduced me to the Russians, to the French. And I think someone like Dostoevsky, though you may not be conscious of it at 14, 15, is actually giving you a path to understand a different relationship to God than what I was getting from those Bible evangelical groups. I think I know I did. I replaced faith. I said I'd given up on faith. I'd given up on God, but not faith. I became a communist, quite. And that was because part of it, it was in my family. My mum's family were rural peasants during the Civil War in Greece, so, and they were left-wing. Dad's family were right-wing, which was a great grounding, actually, because I learned really early that you can argue and that's not a bad thing. Right. Which I think puts me outside some of the Australian experience.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because I think typically relationships in Australia often suffer when even a small, very small, you know, problem develops, and sort of that's the end of that.
I remember another really good friend in high school. I went over to her place for, it was dinner one, because we were working on a project together, and it must have been an election period or something had been happening politically, and I said something about the politics of the moment, right? And her mum said to me, "Chris, in this house we don't talk about religion, politics, or sex." She actually said that. I went back at home and, you know, mum said, "How was it?" And I said, "Oh, they're really lovely, but, you know," she said, "you know, her mum said at one point, you're not allowed to talk about religion, politics, and or sex." And mum looked quizzical and said, "Then what are you meant to talk about?"
Yeah, right.
I became one of those young, angry, righteous but people. I did, and you know what that immersion in the left has given me that I'm grateful for is a sense of social justice, you know. And but I, at that in my early 20s, I was fortunate, and it is fortunate, to travel to Eastern Europe. I was in Greece. And then it was only a few months since the end of communism, and I thought, I've espoused these politics, I should go to these places. And going there as a young man made me confront a really ugly legacy, of people with utopian dreams who had destroyed lives, you know. So that was my second battle with faith, and I came away going, I still consider myself left, but I can no longer use the word communist with any confidence because of that understanding. How's Paul connected to that? At a few years after that, battling my own demons, I was in a point of real despair, and I was working at a place called the State Film Centre in Melbourne. I walked across the road, and there was this little uniting church there, and went in, and this I'm really grateful for, that it was in my history. I just fell to prayer, mate, you know. It was like something I hadn't done since I got up at 15 from that prayer group and said, I can't believe, you know.
Yeah.
And I just fell into that prayer and into that position and into that howling, and I just asked for help. And there was a copy of the New Testament on the pew, and I started reading it. I went immediately to Matthew because I love that gospel. Kind of started reading Paul, and I think I'd read Romans. Because that's the first letter in the canonical Bible. I'd read it, but I'd never ever read it before. I realized I hadn't actually heard Paul because all I could hear was the white noise of, "You are not worthy of God. You are not worthy of His love." And I read something else. I read I read someone who was saying, "I understand your pain, and I understand how difficult this life is, and that there is hope." And I have been, I think Damascus goes right back to that moment.
Which brings us to this powerful presence in Christos's life, the Apostle Paul. I mentioned to Christos that his character, Paul, in Damascus is very human, very imperfect.
It's there in his writings. Well, that what would it mean? What would it mean to have a Paul who doesn't know lust? What would it mean to have a Paul that doesn't know envy? What would it mean to have a Paul that doesn't know wrath? Like, it would mean that you don't have a human being. Mm-hmm. What is astonishing about the Pauline epistles are that they were written by a human being.
What kind of person do you imagine Paul was? He's certainly a passionate person, wasn't he?
Yeah, look, this is where I'm very caught. You know, when I talk about what a fiction writer can do is very, very different to what a theologian does. So you're asking me, who is my Paul? My Paul has to be drawn from within my own battles with faith. So my Paul is someone who knows shame really, really deeply. My Paul knows what it's like to be in a world where you are expected, where meaning is to be married, to have children, to lead this life. What if you don't do that? What does that mean? I think he's, I think there's vanity in Paul. I think there is a cantankerous side to him. And I think that, you know, that's in the letters. Like, you know, he's arguing all the time. Yeah. He thinks he has the truth. But I also think there must be something about Paul who experienced deep love and experienced something of what is, even though I don't call myself Christian, I step a little bit outside that, and we can talk about that. Who clearly knows something about grace and love that comes from God. And Paul, because he is so instrumental in the understanding we have of Christianity, I have been arguing with Paul ever since that moment in that uniting church, but hopefully in friendship, in good faith, in the way I learned as a young kid from those Greeks, who knew how to argue without hating each other.
This is Life and Faith, and I'm speaking with Australian author Christos Tsolkas. His latest book, Damascus, focuses on the Apostle Paul and the early years of Christianity. And I mentioned to Christos that at CPX, our documentary for the love of God really tried to illustrate how radical Christianity was in the value it placed on the individual person, the life of the slave, the life of the female, the life of the person of low birth. That was new, it was revolutionary actually. And a novel like Damascus is able to convey that idea in a really visceral way.
One of the tasks, and you know, it was a task, that I set myself before actually beginning the writing of this book was to sit down. I gave myself a year where I was only going to read and study. And I became a student for the first time in my life doing that. That's how I've expressed it. And I decided that I was only going to read writing between the 4th century before the Common Era and the 3rd century of the Common Era, or history, theology, commenting on that period, right? I discovered, you know, I feel ashamed. I'd never read Virgil before. I discovered some of the most beautiful writing that has ever existed, but I also discovered that the slave did not speak in any of it. Or if they were referred to, they were referred as at its kindness, the way we would refer to a pet dog. In general, they were regarded as, you know, if not fools, worthless. The only time where the slave is treated in dignity in these Latin works, in these Greek works, in these Jewish works that I was reading, is in the gospel. And in the letters of Paul, it's in the that's an incredible revolutionary moment, and to, you know, I have a crucifix that my aunt Yanola gave me in Athens, right? That over 25 years ago, that I wear close to my chest because of a love of her, but I had not really thought about what that symbol means until I started work on this novel, and that you have a faith that says, where is God? You know, God is not in the noble Olympian heights.
No.
You know, God is not in the palaces. No. God is actually the man or the woman you step over who is homeless on the Princess Street Bridge. God is actually the man or the woman who's in prison at the moment. God is the most abject person. That is still revolutionary. That is that is still hopeful in 2020. You know, it's so. I think that reminder is important for all of us, regardless of whether we call ourselves Christian or not. given the grand historic crimes that were done in the name of Christianity, right? Because it became the religion of Rome, so it became the religion of empire, and it became the religion of European empire and colonialism. It is a huge and tragic legacy. But what I want people to understand, and I hope they understand coming out of something like Damascus, is that there is also something astonishing and beautiful in Christianity, which is exactly that is where God exists. You know, that I think that gospel message, which is also in the Paul of the Galatians, is a gift to the world, I think, regardless of where you come from, regardless of your faith tradition.
A pivotal character in Damascus is Thomas, the twin brother of Jesus. Now, in creating this character, Chalkis is drawing on the Thomas tradition, Gospel of Thomas, the Acts of Thomas, and the Book of Thomas the Contender. These are written in the century after the New Testament, and even later in some cases. And while there's no good historical reason to believe Jesus had a twin, and nothing in the New Testament to provide any weight to such an idea, in Damascus, it's the vehicle for an important theological debate that's an important one to Chalkis. Well, let's talk about Thomas, because my sense of your Thomas, so you're drawing on the Thomas tradition, which is much later than the Gospels, but you're introducing, and I thought it was really interesting, but you introduced this twin of Jesus, and this character isn't someone who puts a lot of store on the resurrection. So he doesn't believe that happened. But he's all about, you know, we've got to find joy and justice in this life, in the here and now. And that's what matters to him. And he's really inspired by Jesus to do that. And that's one character that you set against Paul, who says, yeah, yeah, great. But no, you know, I saw Jesus on the Damascus Road and he never recovered from that. And he's saying that this absolutely matters. And I thought one of the really beautiful, I thought you were so faithful to Paul at this point, where you say, my Lord can't be a bystander to this perverted creation. This world is not enough. And so there's this sense that the kingdom of God breaking into the here and now matters. But yes, and there's also a redemptive future that is entirely based on the resurrection. So you set those two against each other. I actually thought you, just by doing that, emphasized the and something that was very true about Paul's theology.
Right. So the notion, when I read the Gospel of Thomas and that theory, which is a collection of Jesus' sayings with no mention, nothing about the resurrection, nothing about the death, really. It's like, what would Christianity be like if it is about the here and now, you know? And I am both existentially and maybe I don't need to put another word. There is something about that idea that is to me true, right? So I'm Thomas in that, you know, I lead. Mm. But I'm so glad you spoke about that particular moment in that final chapter, because that was my where I can't break with Paul either, because I think he's right. Mm. We've got to do something about the world as well as it is. I haven't let go of that notion of that again comes from my Christian upbringing, from so many of the best of what Christianity has done. What I love really about Thomas is doubt, Simon. Like, kind of, I think that's. And going back to my experiences of an early person in that evangelical church, going back to my experience in one of the communist groups, it was doubt that was forbidden.
Yeah.
And right. Doubt is what we should have had. And that doesn't mean that I don't believe in faith either. I think faith is important as well. But I think doubt is equally as important. And that's why doubting Thomas is...
He's kind of an attractive character. I mean, I think he's my favorite. I think he's my wife's favorite character there, because it's the doubting Thomas. I mean, doubt has to be part of a robust faith.
This is how I read. I mean, I feel like I'm conscious that I'm talking about things that you guys, you, someone like you, have thought about for a long, long time. But, you know, just that understanding, again, that is so different from the child's understanding of, you know, when you read the Bible stories as a kid.
Can you comment on how shocking the notion of a crucified saviour was in the ancient world?
So this is the punishment that the Romans had created to say you were, apologies, there's no other word, that you are actually shit. You mean nothing, right? You are. This was for the runaway slave. This was for the most vile criminal, right? You're going to be nailed to that cross. You're going to be strung up. You know, that is, so what is our equivalent? I don't know. It would be like, you know, the prisoner on the electric chair. That's what we pray to, right?
Yeah.
And Paul, you know, the outrage and the scandal, you know, that again, if you cannot come to an understanding of what that means, that God comes through Jesus, a sense of the God, our God, is that they are there on that cross. They are there as the vilest, as the most abject, as the most ugliest, as the most despised. That they are there. That must have been I don't even know if there's an equivalent. There's one moment in the book where I really thought about the use of one word in context of the crucifixion. And I use the word rape, right? And I thought, am I being... And it comes, I think it's in the moment where the young boy is tortured by the pagans. And I thought really hard about it because I didn't want to just be gratuitous in what I was doing, you know. But then I thought, I'm writing this in the shadow of what the Catholic Church has done to these, you know, like... So if... I think if you, and because I know committed Catholics, and because I was there in the days of HIV and AIDS, and I saw what those Catholic nuns hold those boys as they were dying, which no one else was prepared to do. If you can't look up at the crucifixion, if you don't see the raped child, I don't think you're a Catholic of good faith. That's what's radical. That's what's shocking about that's where God is. At this moment, right? So that's what the crucifixion means. And that's, so in that section, I just thought, it doesn't, that's not me being, or wanting to attack Jesus. That's saying, no, that's what Jesus knows. He must. Otherwise, your faith has no meaning. You know, that's Christos Chalker speaking. I don't want to pretend I'm a theologian, but that's.
Yeah, it's God in the ruins, in the human wreckage, isn't it? That's a very important part of that. So the God who suffers with those who are suffering. It's a really big part of that. Okay, well then lastly, you'd know well the text from Philippians 4 that says, finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, and whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent and praiseworthy, think about such things. It's such a lovely list of qualities. I felt like you were kind of holding up some of the best aspects of the Christian story in contrast to the brutality of Rome in painting a bit of a picture for people. Was that something of what you were trying to achieve in Damascus?
Simon, I was, you know, in a way there is always an element of self fishness in the writing of a novel. You're actually trying to work out, you're trying to work out something for yourself, right? It came out of a lot of things. It came out of kind of this long questioning of faith and doubt. It came out of, you know, my father passed away 8 years ago, and again, grateful for the background I have. You know, there's part of Orthodox ritual which was that actually made space for grief, you know, that, you know, so there's 40 days where you go and visit the place my father is buried. He happens to be closest to where I am geographically. So I would, and as the oldest son, I took on and was very grateful to take on that that role, where you go to the gravesite and light a candle, and basically I spoke to my father for 40 days, right? We don't have that in the secular world, right? And I didn't realise it in the writing of Damascus. I've only realised it subsequently. It's a book that wants to show some gratitude for or to be grateful for what I have learned through being a Christian, really. And in the wider sense, I think let us be grateful for what we can create through that, the gospel. I mean, I think the gospel is, even if I'm a little bit heretical, and I would add out that, when I talk about the gospel, I may be also talking about Thomas, and I may be talking about Magdalena. I think actually Jesus's words, they continue to inspire and they continue to awe me, and I just want people to understand why that is so important still in the world.
This has been Life and Faith from CPX. Thanks for being with us. I'm Simon Smart. A huge thanks today to Christos Tsolkas. Again, his latest book, Heretical but Not Blasphemous, is Damascus. Now, we're working hard to contribute to a positive conversation about faith, meaning, and the things that matter. Everything we produce here at CPX seeks to do just that, and it's all made possible by supporters who donate to us. And we'd love you to consider doing just this. Every bit counts. Go to lifeandfaithpodcast.com to find out more. Next week.
I think that a problem for Christians is, in a sense, is that they've been too successful. You know, countries like Australia or Britain are so deeply Christian that you don't actually need Christianity to have its, you know, for its teachings and its assumptions to kind of be everywhere. Who am I to say? But my personal feeling coming out of writing Dominion is that if Christianity as something doctrinal, as something confessional, as something that sees itself as prophetic, is to survive in the modern West, it's really got to be prophetic. It's really got to, you know, be confessional. It's really got to talk about all the stuff that I suspect quite a lot of Christians are embarrassed to be talking about.